Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Conversionary Protestant missionaries. In other words, Protestants that believed in individual conversion, individual commitment, were highly committed to people making educated decisions. They brought printing presses. They invested in mass education of ordinary people as opposed to the elites.
They were not the first to sort of bring about some form of enculturation. The argument is, yes, they came with the good news to spread the Christian message, but in doing so, they also came with Western culture. And this is what many believe led to an erosion of traditional African cultures.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome to the show that aims to get you thinking. Every weekend, were colonial era missionaries good or bad for Africa? That's the question under discussion today. I'll introduce my guests in a moment. And thanks to everyone who turned out for our Unbelievable Live with Sean McDowell this past week. Some really great questions and interactions with Sean. That's going to be broadcast next week. And we've already opened booking for our next live webinar. Very excited about this one. New York's pastor to skeptics, Tim Keller, will be joining me. Tim has very kindly cheered the show on from the sidelines for a number of years now. He's been a guest a few times on the show as well. This will be a chance for you to ask him your questions about his two-year journey with cancer, the state of the church in the USA, your questions about God, suffering, and more. It's all online on Tuesday, the 13th of December. You can book in for free at unbelievable.live. As usual, the link is with today's show. And you can find out about all our other great podcasts and video resources, articles too, at our website, premierunbelievable.com. Keep abreast of all the good content via our weekly newsletter. Signing up there gets you a free ebook on the evidence for God. That's premierunbelievable.com. As I say, links are with today's show. Right now, let's meet today's guests. Today, we're asking, were colonial era missionaries good or bad for Africa? Victorian missionaries very much shaped Africa, the subcontinent, and other parts of the world too, in a significant way during their lifetime. But they were, some claim today, a tool of oppression, exploitation, and oppression. Well, Victor Sims is known as the Zed Historian online, where he produces regular videos on the history of his home country, Zambia, and recently published a video, actually, along these lines, The Dark Truth About Missionaries. We'll find out more about that in a moment. He's joining me today, along with Jonathan Wilson, who's a business entrepreneur in impact investing. He's a Christian who's got experience in international mission and peacemaking. And Jonathan actually comes from a family of missionaries and believes that the story of how missionaries of the past actually positively shaped the nations they went to is often underappreciated. So Victor and Jonathan will be sharing a friendly conversation, I think, today on the impact of missionaries and what effect they had, positive or negative, in Africa, and especially, I suppose, in Victor's home country of Zambia. So great to have you both join me today, Victor and Jonathan. Thank you for doing so. Let's meet you first of all, Victor. Tell us a bit about your background, and you're a historian, and I've been fascinated to see all the videos that you're producing at the moment. Very, very good quality videos on the history of your home country. Tell us how you got into that.
Thank you so much, Justin. Once again, I'm really honored to have been invited to the program to share on, I think it's quite an interesting topic, I must say. And I'm glad that we have Jonathan online, coming from a line of missionaries. I'm sure he'll be able to clarify all the thorny issues. So in my case, I'm a historian by training. I did my BAD at the University of Zambia. And I like to think of myself as an author to some extent. I do write books. I've published two books so far. The first one looked at the history of the First and Second World War, where I tried to focus on the exploits of indigenous African soldiers or askari in the war. Then my second book looks at actually a case of a local operation here in Zambia that involved three serial killers in the local community and how that affected the community. So I would not really look at my writing as historical academic per se, but I would probably think of it as being in the genre of narrative nonfiction. So as a historian, I started sharing or posting to my YouTube channel, which is the Z Historian. My objective was actually to share my country's rich history with the rest of the world and to explore the narratives that probably have not been that explored or discussed. And that being said, as you rightfully put it, Justin, recently I did look at the role that missionary played during the colonial era, or as you put it in the title, it might be what could be the truth behind the missionary work in the colonial era. So I believe that actually is what brought us here. It's actually just a passion I have for sharing history, the history of my country, and also seeing how we can look at the past differently and try to see probably certain aspects that might have been missed.
Yeah. Well, I've had the privilege of very briefly stepping foot inside your country, Victor, when I went to the falls there at the intersection of Zambia and Zimbabwe. It's a beautiful place, I know, to be able to live. And we do have in my own church, actually, a link with the church in Zambia as well, which is great. Jonathan, have you ever been to Zambia? I know that you've certainly been to Africa, but I'm not sure. Yes. About Zambia.
No, not Zambia, unfortunately. So, Victor, one day soon, hopefully.
Tell us, Jonathan, about your background and this line of missionaries that you come from.
Yeah, thanks, Justin. And it's really good to be with you too, Victor. So my great-grandparents were missionaries to the Congo, the Belgian Congo. And that was late 1800s, early 1900s. And then my grandparents followed them. And they worked up in the northern the northern arc of the Congo River for many years. And we're very active, not only doing traditional missionary type work, but also advocating against the atrocities that were taking place at the time against the Congolese people. My mom and dad were then missionaries in a very different area on the island of New Guinea in the South Pacific, which is the western half of it is now part of Indonesia. That's where I grew up. And I spent the first 17 years of my life there. And grew up really seeing a few things that I think have informed my perspective on missionaries, as well as what I know from history. Firstly, I lived in a tribal environment where they had no contact with the outside world except for missionaries. So no colonial contact or very, very minimal. And so missionaries were actually their first point of contact with the outside world. And I watched, I would say, a very healthy transformation take place within that tribe. One that honored its culture, but also saw unhealthy things fall away and good things come more and more into fruition. At the same time, I also watched missionaries of different kinds and different stripes, and I saw the good and the bad and the ugly in different parts of the island. And then the other thing that I think is quite interesting about the context I was in is that because the Dutch handed over Western New Guinea to Indonesia, Indonesia effectively has functioned like a colonial occupant of Western New Guinea. Eastern New Guinea is Papua New Guinea, it's independent. And so I've seen colonial behavior and its many, many problems right in front of my eyes. It's not just a story from history for me. So these things have informed my views as well as, you know, my own studies. And then, of course, my career initially, as you say, was in political mediation and peacemaking in a Christian organization working in the South African context. But then eventually moved more and more into the business sector. And obviously there are people who wonder, well, what does that have to do with being a missionary? Well, in a way, it has everything to do with being a missionary. I have an atheist colleague, we're very close friends, and he said to me one day, I figured out what you're doing. You're trying to save the soul of business. and so that has been a part of my life more recently. And as you say, I'm involved now in investing particularly into companies in sub-Saharan Africa that we think are positioned to really make a difference in their particular locations. That's a bit of my background and how it informs my thoughts.
I've been having trouble all this time pinning down your accent, Jonathan, and I think it's just the fact that you come obviously from so many different places. So there's a bit of I don't know, Canadian and South African, and obviously maybe Papua New Guinean. I even thought I detected some Irish in there. I don't know if that's true, but who knows?
I was born in Scotland, so
right, Scotland. Okay, there you go. So there you go. Anyway, fascinating. And I'm really glad you're with us, Jonathan, because it was a conversation over a year ago now that sparked me thinking it'd be interesting to kind of talk about this issue. And Victor, thank you for coming on to sort of tell us a little bit more about, you know, your perspective as a historian in Zambia. And there is this popular narrative out there that, you know, you don't have to look far to find it, that colonial era missionary work was essentially a tool of oppression and exploitation and empire and so on. It robbed indigenous people of their culture, maybe their natural religion, natural resources, and so on. And to that extent, you know, missionaries are generally frowned upon, you know, the missionaries of yesteryear, and certainly probably today as well, to some extent. We can talk about both. But going back to the missionaries, as it were, of the Victorian era, maybe starting with you, Victor, what's your general response to this idea that they were essentially a tool of the empire in that kind of way?
Okay, thank you so much, Justin. I would like to start firstly by, as you rightly mentioned, the impression that missionaries were agents of colonialism is quite pervasive, and you find it amongst historians, also amongst students of history, and of course even the general public to some extent. Some do actually subscribe to this idea, but I would also want to, maybe before I talk about the missionaries, I would like to mention the fact that normally when we're looking at the colonial era and those that were agents, I would like to think we can call them by different names, those that played a role in the, it could be the political and economic colonization of Africa. There's a focus, yes, on the missionaries, but we also must remember that missionaries were not the only group that was part of that that era. We had also traders, we had explorers, and we also had African chiefs. I think the focus kind of is a bit more harsh on the missionaries, probably because of their mandate being Christians. They were held to a higher standard, if I can call it that. But the first point I'd want to mention was that missionaries were not the first to actually come to Africa, and they were not the first to sort of bring about some form of enculturation, because ultimately that is where the discussion is going to boil around. Mm. The argument is, yes, they came with the good news to spread the Christian message, but in doing so, they also came with Western culture. And this is what many believe led to an erosion of traditional African cultures. But I would also want to remember that even prior to the coming of the Europeans, the issue of cultural superiority or cultural dominance was something that was very common in Africa. As a historian or anyone who knows about pre-colonial African history, we agree that most of African societies were conquest states. So what that implies is that normally you'd have these stronger tribes, if you'd call them that, or these stronger groups who would conquer and assimilate other groups. And eventually these groups they would impose either their culture, the practices, and including their language. In my country, Zambia, a good example is the Luyana, who were in the western part of the country. They had set up a kingdom there, the Barotse kingdom. And in the 1700s, they were actually subdued by the Kololo from the southern part. These were sort of Tswana tribes. So during that conquest, the Kololo actually imposed their cultural beliefs and practices, including their language on the Luyana, which eventually led to them changing their name to what we know now as the Lozi. So that is the first point that I would want us
to
remember.
It's a really interesting point, if I could interject, Victor, because I think what you're essentially saying is it's not as though conquest and a kind of forms of imperialism, if you like, existed within African cultures before the Europeans came along with their particular version of it. So that we shouldn't see this as somehow suddenly something new, but every country, I suppose, has its history of one people or another trying to take control over another.
Yes. So exactly my point. I'm trying to first of all, look at how we need to approach the subject of conquest. Yes, it could be that because the missionaries came at a time when there was, of course, imperialism. And I think many scholars have argued to say many missionaries could have had good intentions, but their timing was wrong because they came at a time when there were other Europeans who were probably more interested in subjugation and, in maybe taking over these African societies and imposing their own cultures on them. So it was quite hard to distinguish. And it could have been the reason why maybe others could have had mistrust of the intentions of all the Europeans, and this would include the missionaries. So the basic, I think the inquiry then should be, it's a foregone conclusion that Africa was evangelized through the colonial mechanism. That we cannot argue. But the point now that we need to consider is, to what extent were missionaries, was it premeditated? To what extent were they willing and, conscious participants of the imposition of the Western culture? Yes.
Indeed. Well, let's come back to that. I'd be interested in some Jonathan's first thoughts on this sort of, as I say, popular narrative that this colonial era missionary work was essentially a tool of empire. What's your overall take on that, Jonathan?
Yeah, and I actually want to start by reinforcing a point that Victor has made about the intrinsic nature, I think, of probably most human communities, that if we're in a position of power and we're stable, we tend to, our self-regard is very high. And our assumptions about the next group over from us is usually that they are a lesser group. And so to give an example from Papua, where there wasn't really the kind of conquest kind of tribal interactions that you would get in sub-Saharan Africa, mainly because the region is so harsh that tribal communities tend to stay isolated. But when they did come into contact, there was definitely I would say almost total prejudice towards this other group. So when Yali individuals, or Yali, actually large groups of Yali people, the tribe that I grew up in, became Christians, they actually started to become missionary-like themselves. And when they began working in a neighboring tribe to the south of us, my dad went down to visit one day, and he realized that this new tribe was now wearing the traditional clothing that my tribe would wear. Basically, which is pretty minimal. So in my tribe, the Yali people wore a gourd, the men wore a gourd over their penis. Whereas in this other tribe, the men literally just wrapped a leaf around their penis. That was their clothing. And so when he saw that men from the Momina tribe were now wearing Yali clothing, which was this gourd, my dad asked, what's going on here? And the Yali missionary said to him, well, of course they're wearing gourds now. They've become Christians.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
But I think that it's obviously inevitable that missionary activity in the colonial period was conflated with colonial initiatives, whether it was the state, whether it was various trading companies, whether it was explorers. But perhaps with the exception of the explorers, missionaries tended to see themselves, not always, but tended to see themselves as very much distinct from the colonial enterprise. Their motives were different. They were often being sent out with the financial support of local churches back in the UK or wherever. There's an exception. They were state-sponsored missionaries, both Protestant and Catholic. But particularly those from the nonconformist slash evangelical, which meant something a bit different back then to what it means now, those types of missionaries tended to actually be a bit of a thorn in the flesh to the colonial actors on the ground. And I can go more into that, but they were seen as an extreme source of frustration because they would frustrate the intentions of the trading companies who were obviously doing their best to exploit local peoples for their resources. Missionaries tended to get in the way of that because they defended the rights of those peoples. They also were a thorn in the flesh to often the government agents that were institutions that were present in places like parts of South Africa, Botswana, Lesotho, and so on. And I'm speaking of Southern Africa in particular, but elsewhere too, Kenya. Precisely because they tended to quickly recognize where something exploitative or oppressive was taking place, and they would push back at that. So we can talk more about that.
But, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It would be interesting too. I mean, I'd be keen to dig into a bit of your local knowledge, Victor, on Zambia specifically. Do you want to tell us a little bit about sort of the history specifically of missionary work in Zambia? Because, of course, one of the most famous probably missionaries that most people can recall was Livingstone. And Livingstone, of course, was part of your country's story. So tell us about that and what perhaps that looked like in his era and how that's played out subsequently in terms of the way Christianity has or has not taken root in various ways in Zambia.
Okay, right. I'm glad you've mentioned the experience, the missionary experience from my country specifically, because another thing that obviously we need to avoid is to generalize mission work. I think Jonathan has touched a bit on that. It would not be quite accurate to group all missionaries. And that being said, even missionaries that were in Africa, in the different parts of Africa, and those that were in the same, operating from the same region, at times tended to probably have different methods of conducting their activities. In the case of Zambia, and that is why normally when I want to give my own assessment of missionary work, I would do my own background research on the missionaries that came to Zambia. And as you may well know, these mostly came after David Livingstone. So I did cover this in my episode on missionaries on my channel, where I emphasized how during the colonial era, the type of missionaries were coming from different backgrounds. There are those that, yes, had the desire to spread the gospel, had the humanitarian, if we could call it that, desire to serve. And of course, there were others who came because of other reasons. And I gave an example of the difference in approach when it came to evangelizing, where you'd find other groups would really focus on the sacraments, the rituals, the religion. It would be more or less like they were presenting these ideas to the Africans who were to absorb them or to accept them without much thought. But there were other missionary societies, mainly which came from the Livingstonian mission, the United Free Church of Scotland. I gave an example of the Luwa mission. It is one which is quite known in my country. The Luwa mission was started with the help of African pastors, if you can call them that, or African missionaries. So for them, their approach to evangelism was quite different because they would engage the Africans intellectually to convince them of the message that they were preaching. And that led to many Africans joining the mission as teachers and as employees of the mission itself. And that is the reason why these missions specifically attracted young and sort of educated Africans, because there was that interaction with the missionaries that came in that area, and they were able to reason with the Africans. Mm-hmm. And like probably other approaches where it would seem as if what was being preached was simply being imposed without any feedback or interaction or input from the local Africans or from the native people. So that could be probably what distinguishes missionary work across Africa in terms of how they approached their work and the background that these missionaries had as they came to Africa.
And do you get the sense from any of your other contemporaries, Victor, or perhaps skeptics and so on, that they take a dim view of the fact that Western Europeans came to share this message, this Christianity, with people in Zambia or indeed across Africa? Because I think that's one of the kind of the assumptions of many people, is it's patriarchal and, you know, and patronizing to go in and essentially say to people, you should believe this instead of the beliefs you've had for millennia, probably, you know, in one form or another. What I mean, is that a kind of a view you encounter much?
I'd say to some extent, yes, there is a general feeling that Christianity was imposed. And I think it takes us back to how the message came. Like I mentioned, the missionaries were not simply seen as individuals that brought the good news, the gospel in itself, but for them to preach the gospel, there were several other things they had to do. They had to probably educate the Africans in reading and writing, or read the Bible to them, meaning that the evangelism came also with aspects of culture. And that is where the argument borders to say the European missionaries actually came with their own a sense of cultural superiority, and considered everything that was African to be bad or to be dangerous or something like that, and that is the reason why they are sort of blamed for even some of the divisions amongst the African groups. So if we were to look at some of the practices and some of the things that the Europeans actually, or the missionaries actually, brought to Africa, we could distinguish some of the African practices that maybe were considered to be inappropriate at the time. And for Africans, they saw it as somewhat an erosion of their culture. So it is something that is there, but like I said, it is something that really requires one to be critical in looking at an issue of culture, because I myself believe culture is dynamic. And I gave an example of several instances where African culture was actually, even prior to the European missionaries, was always fluid in that there was interaction with other groups, other African groups. And this too led to some form of enculturation and alterations in cultural practices.
We'll go to a quick break, and I'd be interested in Jonathan's response to that. And we'll continue to talk through some of these other examples and what both some of the negative and positive aspects are of the missionary work that took place at that time. And we'll maybe get time to talk a little bit about modern missionary work, the good and the bad of that as well. You're listening to Unbelievable. We're talking today with Victor Sims and Jonathan Wilson, talking about colonial era missionaries, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. Were they good or bad for the continent? We'll be back in just a moment.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
We're talking about colonial era missionary work on the show today. Was it good or bad for Africa? Victor Sims, known as the Zed Historian Online, who produces a range of really interesting videos on his YouTube channel, is with us, based in Zambia. Jonathan Wilson also with us. He's a business entrepreneur in impact investing, but comes from a line of missionaries and has himself been thinking about and writing about the way in which actually the work of colonial era missionaries wasn't necessarily all bad, and often the positive impact they had has often been underappreciated. So let's come back to you, Jonathan, because again, I mean, it's interesting to hear Victor spell out there that enculturation wasn't something that only came along with the Victorian missionaries. It had been going on already. And I suppose as a historian, Victor doesn't want to necessarily make a, you know, to say this was good, that was bad. You know, cultures evolve, as it were. And you know, I guess Victor himself, to some extent, is a product of the culture that now exists in Zambia because of its history. So Jonathan, what's your view on all of this and the fact that some people still get annoyed, you know, feel that there's something wrong about Western people coming and imposing their particular religion or even just sharing their particular religion? Because it's hard to avoid the idea that there was, in a sense, a power dynamic going on in some of those instances, you know, those white Europeans coming and with all of their technology and everything else that they might be coming with, even if they were had pure motives, believing that Christianity was they were being called by the Lord to share this message. It's hard not to see that there were some power dynamics also at play when the white missionaries came to, you know, these very remote parts of Africa and so on. So what's your take on that, Jonathan?
There's a lot that I could speak to that you just touched on, but let me see what I can maybe bullet point. Firstly, I think when it comes to culture, I think that it can be helpful to think of culture from a personal perspective, one's own personal identity and culture and growth as an individual. And I don't know many people who don't want to learn new things, to grow, to improve in their lives, or to use a negative example, if they were to find that they had cancer, to have somebody say to them, I know what you have, and I know the treatment for it. You know, I think all of us would want to be in a world where those possibilities are there. But how that comes to us, as you said, you know, the power dynamics, I think makes all the difference. Are we coerced? Are we pushed or forced into certain decisions? And I think there's probably a continuum there when one thinks about the encounter of missionaries with indigenous peoples in the colonial period and today. I think on the negative side, the higher the degree to which missionary initiatives were coterminous or, you know, happening in direct conjunction with colonial activity, the more likely that type of coercive or power dynamic was going on. I think sometimes we have the wrong picture of what life was like back then. It wasn't like, you know, if you imagine the British military spreading out across South Africa when it was trying to combat the South African Boers, the Afrikaners. You have these pictures of just masses of redcoats and eventually, you know, later on they dressed in military fatigues, you know, spreading out across the region. The missionaries were a few here and a few there and, you know, isolated outposts. They were hardly coming with armies behind them or, you know, some sort of political might that was being seen on a daily basis. It just wasn't like that. Often they were in quite vulnerable situations, either to the diseases that would have been in the region or, you know, to the social dynamics that were in the region. So I think those are a couple of factors that are important to keep in mind. As to the question of, you know, the right or the to bring this message, there's a couple of things I would say. Firstly, I think that our view that indigenous peoples shouldn't have been exposed to or subjected to another viewpoint, another message, is in itself rather condescending. And it's presuming upon the indigenous peoples our opinion of what they're, you know, what they should have been interested in or not. It also, I think, can often presuppose, and I've run into this directly, without probably meaning to, the critics are basically imparting to indigenous peoples a bit of credulity, like an inability to discern or to critique what it is that they're hearing or to determine for themselves whether or not it's actually useful to them. And to give you an illustration of that, I once worked with a photojournalist in New Guinea, who came from that kind of perspective, had a very, very negative view of missionaries. And so I said to him one day, I said, well, his name is Brian. I said, Brian, you're here. You're a journalist. Ask the Yali people yourself. Get their opinion, not the your opinion or the opinion of an academic or the opinion of a missionary. And so he was rather resistant to this, but I made him start. I actually forced him to talk to some of the local people. And the first time he asked, I asked the question on his behalf in the local language. And I said, Brian believes that you were kind of overwhelmed and wowed by the medicine and the knowledge of missionaries, the technology that missionaries had, you know, in hand and so on. And that's why you became Christians. And the gentleman that I was asking, he was sitting on a step and he turned to his side and he spat in the ground. And basically his body language was to say, you've just insulted me. And then he basically said, Brian can think whatever he wants to think, if that's how he views us, kind of thing. So, and I could repeat that story. I've got many examples of people being quite offended that they didn't have agency.
And I just coming back to you on that, Victor, I mean, in your own video on this issue, you do say the missionaries weren't always successful wherever they went, were they? Mm-hmm. I mean, can you give some examples of where the message simply wasn't accepted and they moved on and so on?
Yes, that is very correct. It's quite important what Jonathan actually said. The degree to which the Africans themselves had a choice either to accept teachings or not. And like he rightly put it, you know, missionaries did not have oftentimes, and I think that is where they had to rely so much on their association with the other Europeans. They could not provide their own security. So at times they would need security from the colonial administrators and the likes. So that in itself shows a certain vulnerability that shows that these were not groups that could impose a way of thinking on some of the very strong African groups that existed at the time. Yes, of course, for those that probably, if I can give examples of what you just said, there are several instances, and this is the reason why missionaries would move from one area to the other, because you'd find at times the message would not be accepted. I can give an example of when the United, the Livingstonia tried to preach to the Lungu people. It wasn't very successful, and they had actually built a grand church in that area, but the people there stuck to their own religious beliefs, which forced them to move to the Mambwe people, where they were received quite differently. And if you do again consider some of the missionaries that were accepted by the people themselves, I gave an example of the Lozis. You'd find the king himself, that was King Lewanika, actually invited missionaries to his area after he took the throne, and he himself was the person that encouraged his subjects to convert to Christianity. And to that extent, we can't outrightly say there was no agency on the part of the Africans. There were several other instances. Even the Ngoni chief, Bezeni himself, equally invited certain missionaries to come. So the missionaries, actually, there were certain reasons why they were accepted by African communities. Some wanted to learn, yes. It was also the era of slave trade. So for some tribes, they found it safer to be around missionaries because of the security and of course, other things. Some African groups, of course, rejected the message altogether, and they continued with their own religious practices. And I think, like you mentioned, Justin, as we look at contemporary missionary work or evangelism, even today, it's still almost the same narrative. The message is preached, and those who accept it or who with whom the message resonates are easily taken to become part of that mainstream religion. And that is probably something that is certainly overlooked when we look at to the extent to which the Africans could either accept or reject the message from the missionaries. And many, like you said, did reject it, and others accepted it, not because it was imposed, but rather because they probably saw some benefits in the Christian message, which probably we'll discuss later, some of the benefits that they saw from the work of the missionaries.
Well, why don't we talk about some of the benefits? Because I think this is where both of you, you know, I know that your video was titled the Dark History or the Dark Truth About Missionaries, but it wasn't such a negative portrayal in the end, Victor. If someone goes and watches it, you actually talk about some of the positive aspects of missionary work in Zambia and beyond. But before we get to the specifics, perhaps of Zambia, perhaps Jonathan, you can talk to this, because again, this is, I think, where you've been keen to maybe change the narrative a bit on this whole area, because there is this general assumption that missionaries slash therefore colonialism slash therefore racist therefore bad, basically that it's all kind of in you know balled up together. But I know there's been a lot of actual researchers and you've been interested in some of this stuff going on, that looking at actually what kind of positive impact we can say, not necessarily just from a sort of quote-unquote soul-saving perspective, but the actual way in which the missionaries shaped the countries they went to and some of the positive impact that we still feel today, the peoples of those countries. Do you want to kind of give some examples of the ways in which you feel that narrative needs to be given and some of the examples there?
Yeah, and if you don't mind, I'd like to back up a little bit and also talk about motive. So obviously You can't generalize, as Victor has been saying. You just can't generalize across whole groups that, you know, everybody was a particular way. So just for example, you know, the East India Trading Company working in India or the British colonials working in China probably largely were there to, pardon the French, but screw over the local population and to extract as much as they could. But there were also English and Scots who ended up in India, adopted local customs, loved where they were, married local people, had very respectful relationships. And these were not Christians. They were traders. They were colonials. But they were oddities, you know, and they didn't really, that wasn't the typical picture of colonial activity. Equally amongst missionaries, you would see obviously missionaries who are paternalistic or racist. In fact, from what I've read, some of the best educated missionaries in the late 1800s, early 1900s were the most racist. And that was because they were imbibing the Darwinist science of the day, which was being used to justify different theories of different categories, classes of race or different levels of race. But the Andrew Walls is one of the historians that I wanted us to name today, because he and others that I'll name have done remarkable work. And one of the things that Walls points out is that as a rule across the missionary enterprise, there was actually a tremendous other-centeredness. They weren't going to establish an outpost for the UK or you know, some other country from which they came. They were going very much out of a sense of, out of compulsion of love, that God has a love for these people that we don't know. They're not like us. To go among them is to put ourselves, as we've just mentioned, in a highly risky and vulnerable situation. But love compels us to do so because God loves these people and they haven't heard of his love yet. Whether or not you agree with that message, that was a very real and driving motivation. And certainly amongst the Yali people that I grew up, that awareness that somebody would come to you even though they don't have to and make a home among you, even though their previous home is, especially as they became more globally aware, was you know, in terms of lifestyle and well-being and medical care, a more advantaged place to be. That sacrifice inherent in making that, crossing that barrier was seen. I mean, it's powerful. It's very, very powerful. So there's that other centeredness, that kind of barrier crossing impulse within Christianity that Walls highlights and demonstrates He also highlights the fact that the Western missionary tradition is a very recent phenomenon, and that most of that cross-cultural interaction of, you know, sending missionaries and that gospel being planted in a particular area was non-Western, you know, into the West, and then from the West into the global South. And now the global South is the global center of Christianity, not Europe, not America. So I think that motivation piece is important. And then another scholar that I think is really worth highlighting, I don't know, Victor, if you've read much by Robert Woodbury. But Robert Woodbury has done extraordinary statistical analysis of actually what he's been looking at is countries in the global South that have demonstrated economic and democratic stability or health. And what he found was that where particularly what he calls conversionary Protestant missionaries were at work, that appears to have been the precursor to the kinds of conditions needed for stable democratic and economic situations. And he highlights why that was, because it was conversionary Protestant missionaries. In other words, Protestants that believed in individual conversion, individual commitment, were highly committed to people making educated decisions. They brought printing presses. They invested in mass education of ordinary people as opposed to the elites. Catholics tended to emphasize educating those going to the priesthood. The Protestants tended to advocate educating just about anybody who had come through a school's door and in the vernacular, in the local languages. And another scholar, Lamin Sane, talks about the fact that these initiatives actually pave the way for retaining local languages and retaining a local sense of identity that then gave rise to and was able to be a kind of a foundation to the independence movements of the 60s and the 70s in the African subcontinent. So, and I've just named a few of them. There was medical, you know, care and health systems and so on. The other thing, just quickly, I think it's worth mentioning, I've touched on this already, is that missionaries, for example, Botswana is as healthy as it is today, in part because missionaries actively lobbied against whites taking land in Botswana and basically were able to persuade the British to create a protectorate and to guarantee land rights. And that's just one illustration. They were a total thorn in the side of colonial and administrators and traders. And this dimension of missionary involvement is evident actually right across Africa. You hear stories, or there's examples about this in Southeast Asia. Even in New Guinea, where I grew up, my parents, my dad in particular, and another missionary woman that he worked closely with, they really put their legal status on the line in Indonesia, standing up for the rights of indigenous peoples to their land, which was the government was trying to expropriate it for mining companies and, you know, other things like that. So these are the kinds of things that I think there are short-term benefits, but also long-term benefits that have impacted what's going on today in these regions.
I know you're summarizing an awful lot of, you know, much yes, bigger literature there, Jonathan. But to what extent do you see that story locally in Zambia in the history there, Victor?
Okay, great, Justin. I'm glad you asked. If I would like to just pick on one point that Jonathan actually mentioned, how missionaries influenced liberation movements, and I think not only for my country but also for countries like Malawi, he mentioned Botswana, and it is actually very true. I did make mention earlier of the Luwa mission and the type of evangelism that was there, which encouraged Africans actually engage them intellectually and encourage them to think through and to really analyze what was happening there. And as a result, it attracted the more educated young Africans to that church, who are eventually hired or taken on as teachers, and they did all sorts of other works. If you dig into that past, into that history, you'd find all the initial African leaders or politicians actually came from the Luba mission in the north. And the work there can be, of course, attributed somewhat to the works of the missionaries and the missionary church at Luba. Many who have actually studied Zambian history are aware that our first Republican president and a large number of the first cabinet were all young individuals that grew up in the mission at Luba and were influenced, obviously, by the works of the missionaries. His father himself, David Kaunda, his father was actually an apprentice to the missionary Robert Laws, who was stationed in Nyasaland at that time. So Robert Laws himself, as Jonathan rightly put it, he encouraged education. He put up medical facilities. He educated young Africans and built a community where he encouraged even the reconciliation of African groups that probably had fallen out of each other. That was the kind of work that some of the missionaries did. And it is that translated actually into sort of an awareness or an enlightenment, if you may call it that, because obviously some of these missionaries, equally being anti-slavery campaigner, showed that it showed a side that probably the Africans would emulate in terms of fighting for their own rights. And it is this that would be carried on to sort of start pushing for the liberation of the country beyond just the religion that they had learned from the missionaries. It actually gave them the impetus to start thinking of doing more for their country. And I've mentioned names here of young African leaders who were actually church elders, and they used to be church elders at very young ages. You'd find someone is 26, but he's herding, he's probably an elder in a church. Others were deacons and evangelists. And to some extent, I would say the work of evangelists being able to also spread the gospel, it made some of these young leaders very articulate, and it inspired them to oratory. They became very good at you know, communicating messages to others. And this definitely, in the long run, actually helped them to spread not only the message of the good news, but the message of independence itself. As I earlier mentioned. So that is also an aspect, I believe, that if we were to talk about some of the positive results that came from missionary work, aside from all the criticism, I think we'll definitely need to point to how missionaries inspired young leaders or young African leaders to start pushing for their own independence. And they gave them the tools in terms of the skills and the expertise to actually carry out that mission.
And you've been highlighting there, both of you, that in a sense, a lot of the social impact, if you like, of that missionary work in terms of education and obviously these leaders that were raised up and medicine and everything else that goes with it. I mean, what we haven't touched on is to what extent, and maybe this is harder to kind of categorize, the actual spiritual formation or transformation that took place when Christianity came and the people that did accept it and so on. Victor, do you have an opinion on that as a historian, as to what kind of difference the fact, you know, people becoming Christians made to your part of the world?
Okay. Maybe I would say, like you said, it's quite hard to tell how a person, normally you'd expect if someone becomes a Christian, they'll become more morally upright, or probably in terms of character, what would change in terms of character? So it's hard to quantify that, but I would say if we're going to look at the impact in terms of how religion influenced the attitudes and behaviors, Jonathan did make mention to the abandoning of certain harmful practices. I think that would qualify as proving to the extent to which Africans actually started changing. I know of a story, I've just forgotten the name of an African chief who was married to several wives, and then after being converted to Christianity, he had to, you know, relook at his life and abandon some of the activities he was doing to oppress his own people. That should have been Livingston, if I'm not mistaken, who actually ministered to this local African chief. And then there were also other harmful practices, if I may call them that. Others, of course, will argue they were not harmful, like FGM, the female mutilation, which some say was bringing Africans together. But even today, it is a practice that has been actually something that has been identified as something that missionary work actually brought attention to, since it was something that was quite damaging at the time.
Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting example to give, FGM, female genital mutilation, which I think by and large, most people, certainly in countries where that isn't practiced, would say, well, that's a good thing, that if that is being eradicated. And it's one of those difficult cultural questions, isn't it? Is that just one part of the world imposing its particular values on another, or is there actually a fundamental human right at stake about, you know, bodily integrity and so on? I guess there are multiple other examples you could give. One that I've heard spoken of, you know, in India, for instance, Jonathan, is, you know, that it was missionary work essentially that began to roll back sort of the practice of burning widows with their dead husbands, you know, on pyres and that sort of thing in certain Hindu practices. Do you have other kinds of practices in mind that you think were, as it were, a benefit, though inevitably you're coming at it from as a Christian with a certain mindset that of course this is beneficial, even if other people might dispute that from their cultural kind of understanding?
Yeah. Well, so I want to make a point actually about modern West in a second, but I'll start with this. I remember a missionary being asked this question about, you know, the cultural integrity of local practices, in this case, cannibalism, the cannibalization of victims from warfare. And his response was, well, it all depends whose eyes you're looking through. Are you the victim or are you the one eating? So one of the things I find fascinating about this discussion around sort of the imposition of a belief system or moral values, moral principles, and so on, is that we're doing it all the time today. All the time. So depending on which administration is in the White House, the aid package that you would get in Zambia or Kenya or name a country in the continent, will be determined upon your willingness to accept either an anti-abortion position or a pro-abortion position, depending on the administration. And that's because folk in the West will have a very clear opinion. It's just a given. This is a moral absolute, whatever it is that they believe. So these things are being done today routinely. I don't want to speak too much to the specifics in sub-Saharan Africa. Rather be easier and more appropriate for me to speak to the Yali people that I grew up among. And I think the reason I'd prefer to do that is because, having grown up among the Yali, I'd really want the listeners to understand, if they were to come with me to the Yali, they would see that I am Yali, I am seen as Yali, I'm treated as Yali. So I speak about the things that were in the Yali culture as one who loves my people that I grew up among. And the Yali who became Christian would be very, very quick to say that there were aspects of their culture and their lives which were profoundly destructive. They were fear-driven. They had tremendous fear of the ancestral spirits. The idea that you would have this sort of harmonious relationship with nature and the spirits of nature is not actually very widely true, and it certainly wasn't true among the Yali.
You think there's a somewhat romanticized Western view of what tribal folk religion looks like and what it's actually like in practice?
Oh, incredibly so. And it's not that we should say we should also have the same skepticism about our own culture, you know, Western culture and its origins. But, you know, to give you an example, I have a friend, well, he recently passed away, but one of the first Christians amongst the Yali people, his niece wandered into a sacred grove. This would have been before I was born, in the 60s. And she didn't realize that she'd entered a sacred grove. Her uncle found her there And to his great distress, he knew what he had to do with her. He took her back to the village. He told her dad what had happened. And the two of them went and threw her in the river because she transgressed the sacred in a sacred ground and therefore would have offended the spirits and brought calamity. So this had to be dealt with. If a woman overheard religious words or observed a religious ritual, she would either be killed or there would be some sort of a purification ritual, which would usually involve like blood from a pig being sacrificed and then wiped in the eyes and the ears of that individual. There were many, you know, they cannibalized war victims. And when I talked to my friends, who's some of them were of my age, have observed this and were actually taken as young men or as boys, I should say, to watch warfare happen. And then the dismemberment of the victims and the removal of those victims back to the village to be eaten. All of that was done from a place, they would say, and as I listened to them, from sheer malice. How can we do the worst possible to our enemies? And then because these villages are close to each other geographically, you could actually stand on the edge of your village on the mountainside and wave the limb of a victim from the other village and shout taunts across the valley saying, we're about to eat your uncle or your nephew or whatever it may be. Or often women were captured and eaten too. Mm. So these were things that the Yali, nobody put seminars on for the Yali around human dignity and non-cannibalization. These were things that just naturally fell away.
Right.
And the Yali consistently described that transformation as walking from darkness to light. And yet, for many years, if you had spent time among the Yali, to your eyes, they would have looked just the same. In their own thinking, they were becoming who God had called them to become, not turning into little Westerners. Right. And they didn't look like little Westerners.
Yeah. Fascinating. We're going to go to a quick break and we'll come back for more on this with my guests, Victor Sims and Jonathan Wilson. We're talking about the colonial era missionaries. Were they good or bad for Africa? And we'll be continuing and finishing up the discussion in just a moment's time.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back. We'll be continuing our conversation on colonial era missionaries in just a moment, but a quick preview of what's coming up on the profile tonight. As the cost of living crisis continues to grow this winter, Emma Fowles is speaking to Emma Rivi on the profile. Emma is CEO of the Trussell Trust. That's the largest network of food banks in the UK, and many of them run by local churches. She'll be talking about her life, her faith, and how churches can support people through this present energy and cost of living crisis. That's also available on its own profile podcast, brought to you by Premier Christianity magazine. Next week here on Unbelievable, apologist and author Sean McDowell will be with me. He joined me along with hundreds of Unbelievable listeners for a live show this past week and talked about his new book, A Rebel's Manifesto. We also took lots of questions on LGBT, same-sex marriage, transgender, divorce, theology, and more. I thought Sean did a great job of fielding loads of very diverse questions. You'll hear what happened on next week's show, so do come back for that. And of course, you can, as well as listening on podcast and radio, you can get all of our shows over our YouTube channel as well. You can watch them there. Just search up Unbelievable on YouTube. Loads of great podcasts from the past week as well over at premierunbelievable.com, where you can find Ask NT Write Anything, the C.S. Lewis podcast, Unapologetic, Matters of Life and Death, and more besides. We'll have a short chance for some of your feedback later on in the show, but right now let's jump back into our conversation. Welcome back. We're talking about Africa, the missionaries that went there in the Victorian era, the colonial era. Were they good or bad for the continent? And both of my guests, Jonathan Wilson and Victor Sims, today saying that yes, certainly there were bad practices. There were people who were there to exploit, but actually frequently the missionaries were actually a thorn in the sides of the colonialists. And there are various ways in which you could say they had a really positive impact on those countries. And we've been hearing some of that in this past segment. Just before we go into this final segment, just want to encourage you to go and check out The Zed Historian on YouTube. I'll leave a link with today's show and you can find more of Victor's videos there. Some really interesting deep dives into the history of Zambia. And you can also find the episode that we've been referencing, The Dark Truth About Missionaries. Jonathan Wilson, you can find out more about Jonathan at his website, leadbysoul.com. And I'll make sure there's a link to that as well. Just coming back into this final part, there was... just while we were speaking, an article popped into my memory that was shared quite widely among Christians at the time it came out by Matthew Paris, who's a journalist here in the UK. Now, Matthew Paris is a regular columnist for The Times and other newspapers, but he's an atheist. But he sometimes says surprisingly sort of Christian-friendly things. And this was one of those sorts of articles. It was titled, "As an Atheist, I Truly Believe Africa Needs God." I'll just read a couple of segments from it here. Matthew Paris wrote this: "Now a confirmed atheist, I've become convinced of the enormous contribution that Christian evangelism makes in Africa." And I should say, this was the preamble to this was him telling some of his own story of having grown up in Africa as well, and so having some knowledge of the country. He says, "Sharply distinct from the work of secular NGOs, government projects, and international aid efforts, these alone will not do. Education and training alone will not do. In Africa, Christianity changes people's hearts. It brings a spiritual transformation. The rebirth is real. The change is good." It goes on to say later in the article, "Those who want Africa to walk tall amidst 21st century global competition must not kid themselves that providing the material means or even the know-how that accompanies what we call development will make the change. A whole belief system must first be supplanted. And I'm afraid it has to be supplanted by another. Removing Christian evangelism from the African equation may leave the continent at the mercy of a malign fusion of Nike, the witch doctor, the mobile phone, and the machete." So interesting. It's an interesting perspective there from someone, you know, who self-admittedly is not a believer, but nevertheless says he can see the value, the transformation that has happened when he looks at the work of Christian mission agencies distinctly from just, as it were, secular NGOs and aid agencies and things. I know that you're wearing, as it were, a historian's hat today, Victor, and you don't want to maybe, you know, say, you know, become, you know, be too subjective, as it were, in your analysis of these things. But what do you think of Matthew Paris's view there, that Africa needs Christianity in order to thrive and as he says, to have a spiritual worldview that can cope with becoming a major player in the world in general?
Okay, thank you, Justin. I would say the world needs Christianity. Seeing what is happening, it's not just Africa. I think I'm a Christian. Probably my opinion would be biased towards that, but I think there's value from the article. He did mention that the aid agencies, that there's all this help coming to Africa and other parts of the world, of course. But indeed, if there isn't a mind shift change, then you find that most of these efforts might probably to some extent go in vain. Christianity itself, I think, must be looked at it from a practical point of view, what it does to the person, to the Christian, how it informs their judgment, how it informs their thinking and translates into the way they lead their life. In my country, we are a Christian nation. It was actually declared to be a Christian nation by our second Republican president. And to that extent, we espouse the Christian values. And it is quite natural for Africans, I would say, to live by Christian principles, because they are so in tandem with our own cultural values of Ubuntu and, you know, that working together and the belief of being someone's a brother's keeper, working for the benefit of the commonwealth, the community. There's nothing strange about Christian values. And I think some scholars in the past, when they discovered the teachings of Christianity, they said that there's nothing new that has been brought to Africa. It's just the different name calling the same God we've been worshiping in probably almost a similar manner. We did mention, yes, that there were certain practices, and I wanted to take you just slightly back when we looked at maybe the problem that could have existed with the lack of cross-cultural awareness of some of the African traditions. Yes, there are some which could have been labeled as detrimental to society, but other missionaries, of course, did not fully understand several other practices in African culture. And to some extent, these could have been probably what we could have talked about as the negative impact of lack of this, cultural competence, if I may call it that, in understanding some of the cultural practices that Africans had, like the issue of traditional medicines. I think this is something that was probably misunderstood, because there was a thin line between traditional healers and witch doctors and sangomas and all those things. But you'd find the extent to which that was understood by the missionaries and the extent to which they considered it in propagating their own methods might have been something that could have negatively affected African culture. We can also talk about the value of oral histories. It was good in itself that education was brought to the African continent, but it was so book-based that to some extent it ruled out other forms of learning, and that was something that was actually intertwined with the African way of life. Learning for the Africans was beyond what is contained in a syllabi or what is covered in a book, but it had to do with survival, with understanding the environment, with being, in touch with nature and how to actually coexist to some extent. Mm. So those are some of the issues that may have bordered around the lack of probably understanding African culture to some extent. And I think this continues even up to today. Some Christian missionaries, if you could call them that, do go out without probably having the full knowledge of the people and the cultures that they want to speak to. So I think that would be my take.
I'd be interested in your perspective on that, Jonathan, because we said we would try and touch at least briefly on modern missionary efforts. But firstly, just be interested in your thoughts on that Matthew Paris piece as well.
Yeah. No, I think that the whole of mission history, right from the birth of the church in the Middle East through to its expansion across cultures, Christianity is inherently translatable. I think that's something that people who criticize missionary activity don't, apart from, I think, often failing to understand that missionaries are often not possessing the power that we assume they possess. Also that Christianity itself is deeply translatable. It can take root in another language. It doesn't need to replicate an entire cultural system. And yet it is still transformative. And I think that transformation that has occurred in different groups at different times in history, it's so comprehensive and it's so profound. When you think of what I saw growing up as a boy amongst the Yali, the fact that women went from, I think the suicide rate amongst women when I was a little boy was around 10% of women would commit suicide.
Wow.
Because of the misogyny in the culture, to that basically going to nothing. The transformation in, like I said, warfare, and just it got to the point where, if I had a choice about where I could raise my sons today, to be honest, for social reasons, I'd prefer to raise them among the Yali, who are highly communitarian, whose sense of loyalty and commitment to each other makes Westerners look inept when it comes to relationships. And this was, in my view, them coming into their own as a people. How does a transformation like that occur? And I think Victor's point is actually right. The world needs not just a message, not just a set of best practices, so to speak. These all point to a God who is in the business of reaching out to us when we're really stuck, meeting us in our desperation and our own inner brokenness as well as corporate brokenness, and rescuing us. And theologically, the rescue is not promised to happen in this life completely, but there are little signposts of it. There are little manifestations of it, or maybe not so little sometimes. And so I do think that question needs to be asked, is this narrative of Christian history telling us something about not just a belief system, but a God who loves and who rescues? To the question about practices, one of my laments, I suppose, is that in the 50s, 60s, and 70s in particular, maybe into the 80s, there was quite a kind of a trend amongst missionaries to learn anthropology, to learn anthropological methodology and tools and so on, to get training and cross-cultural skills. And for whatever reason, that appears to have fallen away. And I am very concerned when I travel overseas, but actually the same happens when African missionaries come to Canada or to the UK, is just the sheer lack of capacity, as Victor, you know, put it, or competence, to think in cross-cultural terms and to take the time to understand the assumptions and as Victor said, well, what is actually lying behind a particular ritual or a particular way of doing something? What's the good in it, and what's the brokenness in it? And I see that, and where I grew up, I see that, and it really bothers me because the results are actually exactly the negative stuff that we've talked about. It's a minimizing of the value and the depth of quality of indigenous cultural ways.
Are you seeing something that's more like someone just coming and importing a very Western Americanized form of Christianity without bothering to try and see how actually it might find its own shape and nature in the local culture?
Yes, and it becomes very paternalistic all over again. You know, yeah. And it's, you know, over 100 years ago, Roland Allen was writing and saying, we don't go out in order to enlarge the church. We go out as missionaries because we're not yet complete as a people of God. You know, it's two totally different ways of thinking. Yeah. Yeah. And that Roland Allen way of thinking seems to have, it's on the wane.
You know, why is that then? Why do you think we've seen a turn towards, in a sense, a retrograde sort of approach to missionary work in recent years?
I think you should ask the historian.
Victor, what do you think?
I'm not sure.
And I'd be interested in hearing if you're seeing similar things in Zambia as what Jonathan's described there.
Of course, I wouldn't want to really make an assumption as to why we're seeing more or less of a rollback in terms of what Jonathan described, but maybe I would attribute it to some extent, of course, to maybe commercialization of the gospel. I think it's quite different. It's a business now to speak for God, and probably the intentions of the modern day missionaries, if you can call them that, or the evangelists, are quite different in that probably there's that aspect now of probably what they probably gain from being in that mission. So it could be that we're going back to the beginning, where the message now is not what is central to the work of these missionaries. I like what Jonathan said. In the entire debate, I think what is lost is God himself, was why these missionaries came. We started looking at individuals and what they were doing, what they were not doing, and we missed the essence of them coming with the message. And I think that is what is happening even now. We have politicized the work of God. We've politicized the issue of religion. Some have commercialized it. For some, it's a business. It's now what is known as the prosperity gospel and all these new phenomena. I think that is what could be, in my view, leading to an erosion of that sort of a real authentic desire to spread the good news.
There is actually, after I passed on the baton to Victor, I realized there is actually one quite important thing that I do know about, and that is, you know, even in the day of my parents, if you wanted to go to somewhere extremely remote like Indonesia or to eastern Indonesia, You could never just do that on your own initiative. You needed to go to a mission agency who had the relationships, who knew the region. And because, you know, most of those agencies had learned lessons over the years, and they were the ones saying, okay, first you need to get this training. Whereas today, if you want to go and work in Zambia or Malawi or New Guinea, you just buy a ticket and you go. Unless the only barrier is whether or not the local government will give you a visa. And so I think that is a big factor. It's the quote-unquote democratization of global movement and travel, but it actually has this effect.
I wonder to what extent also just the fact that the whole of the world can come to the palm of your hand through your phone, your mobile device, and everything else is also having the effect there. And you know, even across the West, there's been a kind of Americanization in many ways. And I wonder if we're sort of seeing that in terms of the religiosity and the kind of attention that gets afforded to the televangelist types and everything else that might not have simply been as prevalent or obvious in decades gone by. These are probably issues that take us beyond the conversation that we're able to have on the program today, though. And I've really appreciated, though, both of your thoughts and the history that you've been able to bring to us, especially from both of your perspectives. Any final thoughts, Victor, as we close this out? Anything you want to share as someone who's now, as it were, living in the wake of both the good and bad of the missionary experience in Zambia?
Okay. I think in closing, it reminds me of a scripture in the Bible. It should be in Philippians 1:18. I think the writer was talking about, they were questioning the motives of those that were preaching the gospel. And I think the writer said something to the extent that whether in pretense or truth, Christ is preached. Of course, I wouldn't want to put it across as a justification for people with ulterior motives, but I feel the discussion must, in as much as we acknowledge, it's a foregone conclusion that the missionaries did play a role. They had to play a role because of actually what was happening during the colonial era and on this show with the experiences that Jonathan has actually given us. We have seen that to now generalize that to sort of kind of make it the entire narrative of missionary work in Africa, even from a historical point of view, as a historian, I think it would be quite inaccurate if we do not consider all the possible perspectives of looking at an issue. But beyond that, as I was saying towards the end, what is important is what they managed to achieve despite their inadequacies, despite their flaws and the mistakes that were made by missionaries. And like I said, it's not just the missionaries. It's everyone who was involved in that colonial machinery, which included the African chiefs, the African people themselves, African traditional and religious leaders. We have to take the blame collectively and say beyond the mistakes that we all made, what was the Christian message and how has it changed the lives of people in Africa coming from a Christian nation. I would say the majority of Zambians are Christians and we believe in Christian principles. And that has taken us quite far in terms of being a peaceful people, being a peaceful country, having peaceful transitions in all sectors. We to some extent, there's no denying that can be attributed to our Christian beliefs, regardless of how they came to Africa. We have to be glad that they actually did, like Jonathan said. These are men who sacrificed, others died in the cause of spreading the gospel. So we have to look beyond probably the obvious. I would say most critiques, they don't really bring anything new because all the arguments are quite obvious that this is what was happening. But then what are we saying? What is now the overall take from the story of missionaries coming to Africa and its impact on the world?
Well, you have to sort of go from where you are, don't you? And as you say, as far as you're concerned, there's been a lot of good that was done, even with the bad that sometimes came along too. Jonathan, any final thoughts from you?
Yeah, I would hope that for folk who are listening, and I realize your audience is quite diverse, that for those who are Christians, that this conversation would have renewed their awareness of the missionary nature of God. And I mean that in the best sense of that word, that willingness to go out across the boundary, to reach out to those who are not in your group in order to love them. But how do you love them? By, you know, rocking up and being the hero, you know, the guy on the white horse? No, by coming in as somebody vulnerable, as somebody who's a servant. You know, to use theological language, the incarnation, you know, that Jesus modeled is what missionaries, I think, at their best were attempting to do, to enter into somebody else's world, not their own world, and be a present, proximate servant, coming in alongside others. And I think that theologically there's a strong case to be made that the God of the Bible is a God who takes joy in the diversity of cultures. And, you know, there's a vision, you know, in terms of the coming together of all things at the completion of God's work in history that sees, you know, to quote the book of Revelation, every tribe and every tongue and every nation. There's a rich, rich multicultural expression there of people who are glorying in the God who loves them. But for those who aren't Christians, I would say equally, you know, if your commitment is the world needs to be a better place, I think there's lessons to be learned from the missionaries. You know, that you are you willing to pack your coffin the way my great-grandmother did, knowing that you might die where you're going just because the risks are so high? Are you willing to take risks for the sake of other people? Are you willing to enter the world of people who are suffering the most in today's issues in order to be alongside them and collaboratively build the solutions that are needed rather than impose your own? There's too much kind of hero, kind of messianic sentiment, I would say, in the West, especially in the business circles that I move in, that we're just going to solve all the problems with our awesome, you know, technology and know-how and so on, without any humility and without any commitment to actually enter the lives of those who are suffering and help them use their ingenuity to build solutions. So those are some of the things that I would kind of conclude with today.
Well, it's been really fascinating discussion between you both. Thank you so much for taking some time to talk through these issues. I hope if you're watching or listening, it's been helpful for you as well. It's been a really interesting discussion. Just again, if you want to find out more about Victor's work, Zed Historian is what you're looking for on YouTube. There's a link with today's show. And Jonathan Wilson can be found at leadbysoul.com. The link again is with today's program. But for now, Jonathan and Victor, thanks for being with me.
Thank you. Thanks, Victor.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us on today's show. You can email me with your thoughts on this conversation, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I read all of the emails. I don't get to respond to all of them, and we try and bring as many as we can in our feedback. We're not going to have much time for your feedback today, though, so the responses we've had to last week's climate change discussion between a humanist and a Christian, we'll save some of those over for next week. You can also get in touch with the show on our social media at UnbelievableFE. Is where you can find us on Twitter, facebook.com/PremierUnbelievable to follow us on Facebook. All of the links are available from today's show. Just want to give a quick shout out to an event that's coming up on Saturday, the 10th of December at Elim Church, Bristol. It's a gathering to encourage confidence in Scripture. It's going to have some excellent international communicators, including Brian Broderson, Dr. Andy Bannister, Claire Williams, Dr. Peter Williams, Cheryl Broderson, and Andrew Ollerton, all speaking with confidence into why we can trust in the Bible in the 21st century. All of those names, in one form or another, have appeared on The Unbelievable Show at various points. So it's great to see all of those guests together. This is actually a Creation Fest event being held, a one-day conference titled Why Trust the Bible. So if you want to find out more about that, go to creationfest.churchsuite.com/events. You can find out more about it. Creation Fest putting on a Why Trust the Bible event, Saturday 10th of December at the Elim Church in Bristol. Thanks also to this lovely email I received just this past week from Theophan Vanderwood saying, Christ is in our midst, Justin. I was wondering if you'll be having any more Eastern Orthodox Christians on the show. Your own show was instrumental in my acceptance of Christ's claims about himself. And from there, I myself was baptized into the Orthodox Church with my family. I'd really love to hear more discussions on orthodoxy, perhaps maybe a conversation between N.T. Wright and Father Josiah Trenhan or Father John Whitford. Perhaps it's a pipe dream. Regardless, thank you for your show and how it's helped me on my journey to Christianity and the Orthodox Church. Thank you very much, Theophan. It's lovely to hear from you. And I hear increasingly from people who have moved towards the Orthodox Church. In fact, of course, we had the conversation between Rowan Williams and Paul Kingsnorth earlier in the year as a part of our big conversation on Paul Kingsnorth's own conversion to Eastern Orthodox Christianity. You ask if there's anything else coming up. Yes, in fact, one of my guests for an episode of the show coming up around Christmas time, where we'll be specifically hearing some interesting stories of conversion, includes a guest who has himself had a rather remarkable conversion to Eastern Orthodox faith. So I won't spill the beans too much on that one, but it's a rather sort of Paul Kingsnorth-esque journey that this person's gone on as well. And next year on The Big Conversation, we'll be featuring a conversation that includes Rod Dreher, who, as you probably know, is also a convert to Eastern Orthodoxy. So, yeah, we've got some things in the diary, and who knows what we could do with those suggestions of yours as well. But thanks for being in touch. It's always very encouraging to hear of people whose, faith has been influenced in that way by listening to the show over the years. That's all we've time for today, I'm afraid, for your feedback. So we'll have more chance for it next time. But for now, thank you so much for joining me on today's show. Look forward to hearing what you made of it. You can email again, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And next week, let me tell you what's coming. Sean McDowell joins me as we hear what happened when he was joined along with hundreds of Unbelievable listeners for a live show, talking about his new book, A Rebel's Manifesto, but taking lots of questions on LGBT, same-sex marriage, transgender, divorce, just the small stuff, you know. Well, we called it culture war questions, so I guess that was very much how we set it up. And yeah, you'll hear what happened on next week's show. For now, thanks for being with us. God bless you. See you next time.